At that point in my life, I realized that it was wrong to abuse the destructive power we had. You only hurt people when it's necessary, I told myself. My boys were upset with me for not giving them the green light, but I knew it was the right choice. After a few hours of partying, Money No, Godfather, and I left early with some girls. It was close to Christmas, 1997, and snow and ice lined the ground outside. Money No and I walked to the parking lot to get my car, while Godfather walked with the girls to their car. Money No and I were waiting for the light to change to cross the street when we saw Keith Murray with four of his boys standing 10 feet to our right. "Yeah, what's up now?" one of his boys said to him. "Let's see what's up now." "Pass me your gun," Money No said. I had a big 9mm on my hip all night. "Nah, chill," I said. I wanted to fire the shots. "What's up with all that shit you was talking on your album?" Keith Murray walked up and asked after his boys pumped him up with gas. "Are you serious?" I looked at him and asked. "How am I gonna shoot this dude and get away with it?" I was thinking. "All right, I'm gonna take him down the dark shadows toward 10th Avenue." One of Keith Murray's boys and Money No started beefing about who could fight better. I suggested that we take it across the street, out of sight, so the cops wouldn't break us up. They reluctantly agreed. As we crossed the street, Money No kept asking for the gun, but I refused. I couldn't wait to get in the shadows of the next block and see the look on their faces when I started squeezing bullets at them. Now, should I shoot to kill, shoot to wound, or shoot to scare them? I decided to just shoot Keith Murray and wound him. A police squad car was coming up on my left when we got to the double yellow lines in the middle of 11th Avenue. Keith Murray jumped in front of me like he changed his mind about stepping into the shadows across the street. I could see him ready to swing. "The cops are right there," I warned him. "Chill until they pass." But he decided to punch me in the mouth in front of the cops. How corny is that? My first thought was, this nigga punches like a girl. My second was, get distance between these cops immediately before backup arrives and we all get frisked. The police put on the sirens and lights. I ran to get rid of the gun behind the van, tossing it in the snow, covering it with more snow. Then I looked up. Money No knocked out Keith Murray's man. He hit the ground and slid on some ice underneath the cop car. As I was walking back toward them, Keith Murray was talking to the cops, pointing at us, saying that we started it. The police was cool. They simply said, "You guys go that way, and you guys walk the other way." Them niggas don't even understand how lucky they are. God was truly on their side. I guess God was on my side too, because I might have gotten locked up. Keith Murray must have felt death down that dark street. When he saw that squad car coming, it must have been like Jesus Christ coming to save him. New Year's Eve 1998 fell on a Sunday, and the tunnel was on fire as usual. Godfather and I stole two hoes from their pimp, Diamond and Strawberry, Puerto Rican dimes from Albany. They told us homie was lame, pimping them in the club every Sunday, and they wanted to work Queensbridge. We headed out the club with them. I realized that I left my car keys with Gotti, gave my gun to Godfather, and told him I'll be right back. Back inside the tunnel, I walked all over trying to find Gotti. I noticed dudes wearing Death Squid hats, Keith Murray's crew. I saw two hats, four, and more. Minutes later, with the dudes following, I bumped into Karate Joe, Bill Cosby, Nitty, Twin, Gotti, and a bunch of the 12th Street crew. I told Gotti to give me my keys. "These dudes is following me," I told Karate Joe. He didn't even wait for me to tell him who. Karate Joe punched the face off the poor dude. I bumped into Karate Joe, Bill Cosby, Nitty, Twin, Gotti, and a bunch of the 12th Street crew. I told Gotti to give me my keys. These dudes is following me, I told Karate Joe. He didn't even wait for me to tell him who. Karate Joe punched the face off the poor dude behind me, who wasn't even down with the death squid. The 12th Street crew started fighting everybody behind me. Twin grabbed me out the way, holding me behind him, slicing and dicing faces with a razor. I asked him to give me one. Twin just kept cutting, not even hearing me. We chased the death squid pussies through the club. I ran outside and told Godfather to give me my gun, thinking that whatever was left for the death squid would come running out, but they never came. 10 minutes later, the crew strolled out laughing. Where's the death squidron? I asked. Them niggas in there bleeding, Joe said. They probably need an ambulance. Godfather, the girls, and I walked to the parking lot to my new black Lexus GS300, which I bought with some of my feature money. We drove the hoes to a cheap motel next to the Holland Tunnel where their pimp kept them to get their clothes from their room. They ran out the hotel with 2 stuffed garbage bags. We took them to QB and started pimping them the next morning. Diamond and Strawberry were 2 good-looking Puerto Rican broads with fat asses and nice bodies. We took them to Chang's, the Chinese food spot on 40th Avenue. Mr. Chang and his employees were our first customers, in the car behind the restaurant. Then we walked around the hood with them and made a few $1,000. It gave me a new respect for pimps. Pimping ain't easy. It's a full-time job, and I ain't got time for it. My run as a pimp was over within a week. Godfather kept Diamond and Strawberry for another month and got tired of it too. So he left them somewhere in the city. I told Kiki what we were doing, but she probably didn't even believe me. A spiritual war was going on within me. All the things I was learning about life and health had me wanting to stop doing the drugs and living the grimy way I was living. But at the same time, all the stress and pain, drama and criminals around me made me not care about being peaceful and cleaning up my act. My coke habit and drinking were affecting my sicker cell. All the partying was finally starting to catch up. Not long after my little pimping episode, an OG in Queensbridge went to cop a bag of coke for me in the projects late one night. This was our regular routine, because I didn't want people to see it was Prodigy buying from them. Never send a broke cokehead to buy coke. The OG came back and gave me a bag of something that wasn't coke, or coke mixed with something that smelled and tasted like plastic. Now, I don't know if the dealer gave him a bad bag, or if he dipped in my bag and replaced what he took with some bullshit. Later that night, my head hurt, and my sinuses swelled up above my eyes. My sickle cell started acting up, and I had to go to the hospital. They told me I might have spinal meningitis and stuck a needle in my spine to remove some fluid. I didn't have meningitis. I knew damn well it was from the coke. My head looked like E.T., and I felt ugly and embarrassed when Kiki came to see me. The doctors asked Kiki and Uncle Lenny to leave the room for a moment. They told me that they found cocaine, PCP, and marijuana in my blood. When Kiki and Lenny came back, I admitted that I was using cocaine and angel dust. Kiki was mad as hell, and when I explained how long I'd been using, she couldn't believe it. After I healed, Kiki told me when she saw my face and head swollen like that, and found out about my drug habit, she wanted to leave me. That scared me into wanting to change my life. Sickle cell pain had brought me close to death many times, but the thought of losing Kiki was worse. It was time to put all the righteous information I was learning about into serious practice. It took a few more bangs on my hard head for me to finally get my shit together. But from that night on, I never used cocaine again. Twin and I waited for an hour in the freezing cold to get inside the tunnel one night, about a week after my hospital stay. Chris Lighty wasn't at the door, and the bouncers were hating on us, making us wait outside forever. The cold triggered my sickle cell. By the time I got inside, I was in super pain, with no pain medicine. I thought of my own remedy. I drank Hennessy until I was numb. The next day, I went to the hospital and had to stay for a week. My man Shamik from Left Rack came to visit me and brought fish, biscuits, and shrimp from Red Lobster next to Left Rack City. He made surprise visits with Red Lobster a lot when I was in the hospital. We talked about the latest jewelry, fashion, and rap drama. Shamik was a cool dude. He had come up since the nickel and dime days, became real big time in the drug game. A few days after I came home from the hospital, Shamik invited me to Gordon's Strip Club on Hillside Avenue in Jamaica, Queens. He was meeting his homeboy E Moneybags and Nas, so I went. Shamik was selling drugs for E Moneybags, and they were talking in code language about their dealings, while Nas and I spoke about the Nation of Islam's 120 lessons in the rap game. We drank for a few hours, and then we left. My niggas and I were never into giving our money to strippers or getting lap dances. Always looked at dudes who did that like they were herbs, suckers, or cornballs. Tricks is the pimp terminology for those types. While I was driving Shamik back to Left Rack, I asked him to give me the 120 lessons. Sha was what we call God Body from the 5% Nation, now known as the Nation of Gods and Earths. Males are called God Body, and women are Earth. They believe that the black man is God, and that we shouldn't be praying or waiting for Jesus to save us. We should be creating our own destiny. And if we want life to be better, then we must make it that way by doing positive things. They have some very interesting concepts, and I didn't want to join them. I just wanted to acquire their knowledge. Shy had been given his God Body name, Shamik Allah, when we were little kids in Lakeview. Growing up, there were a lot of gods in Hempstead and Lakeview, Long Island. And ever since I started reading Dr. York's books, I wanted to study the 120 lessons and learn knowledge itself. Dr. York teaches that we should know the origin of all things, and I wanted to learn their origin. Shy ran up to his apartment and came back with an unbound booklet of lessons. People would Xerox loose copies and pass them around. Some people even hand wrote the lessons with a pen and pad. I went home and didn't stop reading until I was finished. Like I said, I wasn't planning on becoming a follower anyway. I'm just an addict for information, especially the facts. I started realizing that all religions were created to control the masses on this planet. They control the people through fear of God and the devil. Heaven and hell. Dick and my nuts. I'm not into race hating, and I don't rely on religion for my spiritual health. I've got my own relationship with the Creator. The only thing I believe in are facts. And the fact is that when we were in Africa living in peace with the universe, we didn't have Bibles or corrupt corporations. We were spiritual people with our own way of life. We didn't need for anything because it was all there for us naturally in infinite abundance. Africa is the cradle of all humanity and civilization. We were advanced in technology, agriculture, architecture, medical procedures, math, science, astronomy, astrology, and health practices long before the Greeks and Romans. Don't believe the lie when they say Caucasians came to Africa and found black people living in destitution as unruly, cannibalistic bush babies, and they had to save us from our evil, savage ways, clean us up, civilize us, and transform us into wholesome, upstanding Christians. This is all propaganda created by the Caucasian pirates to conceal their true agenda of the largest land, natural resources, knowledge, and population heist in history. Not to mention the largest mass genocide. We thrived independently for millions of years before they invaded our lives with their wickedness and lifestyle of the beast. When we were enslaved and shipped to America, the Europeans forced us to follow fairy tale religions so that they can control our minds. They forced their banking system on us to control our lives with money. If we don't agree with their system and refuse to believe in their religions, then we get killed, sent to jail, or locked in a mental institution. I could write an entire book on that subject alone, and I will. Chapter 7. Murder music. Vision the canvas, I paint a picture. Similar to Ernie Barnes, nigga. But mine's is more ghetto, more guns. More drugs, mostly thugs. All of my thuns, they baby mom, daughters and sons. Streets raised me. In early 1998, Havoc and I decided to open a new album budget with Loud Records so we can get a new check. Loud agreed that it was time for it, so they gave us 6 figures and we started working on our 4th album. I came up with the title Murder Music because the songs we've been making sounded so sinister, like murder music. I told Havoc that we should buy a house and live together as a team. Godfather, Twin, Gotti, Nitty, Havoc and myself, so we can constantly bang out songs. We found a perfect brand new 5-bedroom mini mansion in Freeport, Long Island. Built a studio in the basement, and we all moved in. Kiki and Shaka too. That tan house with forest green shutters, a front porch, a small backyard, was the first piece of property that Havoc and I ever owned. I put the entire house together myself. The gray carpet, wooden blinds, furniture, TVs for every room. Havoc let a couple of extras move in. Papa Mob, aka MCT, from Queensbridge. He was pushing 50-something. And Tom Nitty's cousin, Bolo. I knew it was a bad idea, but Havoc wanted them in, so I agreed. I even let Havoc take the biggest room in the house so he could feel good about being home. Determined to live a peaceful, positive life and make smart business decisions, I tried my best to get all my boys to do the same. But we were a bunch of savages, and I was the only one ready for a change. I posted house rules on the refrigerator and gave everybody a job to do. From the beginning, I could tell that Bolo was lazy. He didn't rap or produce and was just a deadbeat. Once a week, I called house meetings in the living room. Get a hotel if you with a girl, because I don't want nobody to know where we live, I told him. Or blindfold your girls before you get off the highway exit so the bros don't know where they're going. I had Kiki and Shaka with me, and I wanted to make sure my family was safe. Within 6 months, the guys were breaking every rule. Havoc was the main one breaking them, and the others followed him. It felt like they were talking behind my back. P's crazy with all these house rules. We're partying in this bitch as soon as he's not looking. And they were. Kiki was disgusted by the way my friends were living and the number of girls that she saw coming and going. She found a list of symptoms of HIV/AIDS and taped it to the refrigerator next to the house rules. The next day, the paper was gone. I guess it made somebody feel insecure about their health. Godfather, his boy Tomax, and I were heading home from Soundtrack Studios at 3 o'clock in the morning. Just as Left Rack was coming up on our left on the Long Island Expressway, a giant bright green fireball about the size of a falling planet shot down from the sky. I almost crashed the car. Oh, shit! I yelled. Did you see that? See what? Godfather asked from the passenger seat. Son, you ain't just see that big green fire just now. No. I just closed my eyes to go to sleep, he said. Tomax, you ain't see that? I asked. Nah, I just closed my eyes too. I couldn't believe it. We were all wide awake and having a conversation just seconds before. The clock on the dashboard read 3:33 a.m. I have been studying books on numerology, and to see something that extraordinary at that exact time was obviously a sign, and a sign meant only for me. In Dr. York's books, he said that God's angels, the Elohim, use green fire, and the evil forces use amber or red fire. My pops and I used to watch shooting stars and comets at certain times of the year, but there was no comparison to what I had just seen. Pops and grandmas told me that when Pops was young, they saw a multicolored UFO in Virginia hovering above a store for several minutes and then take off with light speed. At the crib in Freeport, nobody believed what I had seen except for Godfather, Twin, and Gotti. I had been praying and asking the Creator to show me a sign or some type of proof that all the things I was learning about the origin of life on Earth were in fact true. I was grateful to receive a sign, but furious with the Most High for not giving me a witness. Maybe I'm bugging, I thought. They had me doubt with my own eyes. The brand new mini mansion in Freeport was slowly but surely becoming disgusting. Carpet stains, sticky shit on the hardwood floor, garbage overflowed, and dishes piled up in the sink. Kiki was 7 months pregnant and fed up. Bolo was lying on my $8,000 gray suede couch with his stinking feet up when I came home one afternoon. Yo, this nigga Bolo is a bummy, dirty-ass motherfucker. I told Bolo to clean up or get out, calling him Benson and Mr. Belvedere so he'd get mad and want to fight. He laughed it off and started cleaning. Havoc and Noy were at Platinum Allen Studio, working on murder music. I arrived a few hours into the session, and Havoc had this ill beat playing while Noy was writing a verse. I rolled the blunt, kicking rhymes in my head. I put my lifetime in between the paper's lines. I'm the quiet storm nigga who fights rhyme. Hav left with Noy to meet some girls. What? I couldn't believe that they'd rather meet girls than make a new song to this incredible beat. It was one of the best beats I ever heard. I smoked my blunt and started writing one of the best rhymes ever. Are you the same too? Going through the emotions, a gun holding, long shotguns down my pants, leg limping. Killer B, you still living. Even my pops too, he taught me how to shoot when I was 7. I used to bust shots crazy. I couldn't even look because the loud sound used to scare me. Pah! I love my pops for that. Love my nigga, he black. Take the life of anybody trying to change what's left. I spent too many nights sniffing coke, getting right, wasting my life. Now I'm trying to make things right. Nigga, please, don't make me have to risk my freedom. We worked our whole life for this. I finished the song in 3 hours and named it White Lines for the time being because the sample was from the old Melly Mel song of the same name. When I played it the next day, everyone liked it, but they didn't understand the power that that song had. I immediately gave it to DJ Clue, who started playing it a lot. Meanwhile, I got a new budget for my solo album, H&IC, and rumors flew that Mobb Deep was breaking up because Prodigy was going solo. You guys are breaking up? Radio interviewers and random fans on the street were asked. You're going solo? It wasn't true. I had a hustler's mentality, and doing a solo album only meant more money in my bank. I wrote so many songs, I couldn't let them all pile up and collect dust. Plus, the fans always said I was the best rapper in Mobb Deep. I never felt I was better. Havoc used to write my rhymes, and he spit some of the best verses I ever heard. But that's what everybody else told me. Even Havoc. So it was inevitable. See, I told you that you was better than Nas, Twin said. Do you think you better than Nas now? He'd always ask. No. But when I was sitting writing verses, in my head I was thinking, shit, I'm the best rapper to ever live. Stobo, Twin Gambino, and I linked with the rapper Big Pun at his crib in the Bronx one night to head to a club called Carbon on 56th Street and 11th Avenue in Manhattan. The same spot where the Scarface twin once carved QB in the kid's face with a razor. Pun, or Big Punisher as some called him, was our new label mate at Loud Records. We got real cool after collaborating on the songs Tres Leches. In the kitchen at Pun's house, Pun was sitting in front of the refrigerator with the fridge and freezer doors open and a table fan inside blowing the cold air on him. True ghetto air conditioning. "Please, Pun, you gotta stop doing all this gangster shit." Fat Joe was begging and pleading with Pun. "You're a celebrity now. You can't keep beating and trying to kill people. You gotta chill with all that." "Listen, I'm not trying to hear nothing you're saying right now," Pun said. "First off, I wasn't trying to kill him, and second off, P is here, so shut the fuck up. Yo, P, what's up, man?" "Pun, I saw you with the knife in your hand about to stab the guy," Joe said. A big knife with spiked brass knuckles attached to it was lying on the couch in the living room. Pun walked into the living room where Twin Gambino and I were checking out his knife. "That ain't shit," Pun said, turning to one of his 15 friends hanging out in the house. "Show P your gun." The kid reached down to his ankle and pulled out a federal issue mini 45 caliber, all black, plastic, about 3-4 inches long. Then Pun looked at another one of his friends. "Show P your gun." One by one, all the dudes said, "Look at this one. Look at my gun. Check this one out, P." Until 13 guns are out. Pun looked at me and said, "Show us your gun, P." "My gun is in the car," I said, feeling dumb. "Don't ever do that again," Pun said, disappointed. "If we were foul, we could have a drop on you right now." Pun's debut album, Capital Punishment, went platinum that year. And sadly, when he was recording his follow-up, Yeah Baby, he died from a heart attack and complication from being overweight. I really miss that dude. R.I.P., big homie. Ray Benzino from the rap group RSO, and who was the co-owner of the Source magazine at that time, had a production company called Hangman 3 that made good beats. He invited me to his mansion in Boston, where he had a studio so we could work on music for my solo album. My fake cousin Stobo came with me. We met Benzino and his Source partner, Dave Mays, at JFK Airport and caught a quick flight to Boston. Toward the end of the flight, the captain made an announcement.
"Now, this is your captain speaking. We seem to have a problem with the landing gear. You're going to have to circle around for a while and see if we can get it working so we can land. I'm sorry for the inconvenience."
10 minutes later, the captain got back on the loudspeaker.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry to announce that we're going to have to make an emergency landing without the landing gear. We have fire trucks and ambulances waiting on the ground for us. Please do not panic."
An East Indian guy sitting in front of Stobo and me pulled out his credit card and used the airplane phone in the headrest to call his wife.
"Baby, my plane is about to crash. I love you," he said. "I probably won't ever see you again."
It was Stobo's first time on a plane. He closed his eyes. We were both scared to death. Just as the plane was nearing the runway, the wheels dropped down and we landed safely. The driveway outside Benzino's mansion was lined with Ferraris, Bentleys, and Lamborghinis. Stobo and I stayed for 2 days and found 2 beats. One I never used, and the other one became What You Rep, featuring Nori. Nori had just dropped his self-titled solo album, and a new rapper from Harlem, Cam'ron, was starting to make some noise with another rapper from Harlem, Mace, who was already on fire and signed to Puffy. Dave and Benzino put together a Source magazine tour with Nori and Cam'ron as the headliners. I hadn't spoken to Nori since he shot Johnny in the leg by mistake,